This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Bernie Sanders throws his support to Hillary Clinton at a rally in Portsmouth.
I have come here to make it as clear as possible as to why I am endorsing Hillary Clinton and why she must become our next president.
Congress sends President Obama a bill to tackle the opioid crisis. New Hampshire's Kelly Ayotte is among its backers.
This truly is a thoughtful, thorough approach to addressing what is a public health epidemic.
And the eyes of the political world turn towards Cleveland and the Republican National Convention. One matter dear to New Hampshire may already be resolved, though, for 4 years at least, the future of New Hampshire's GOP presidential primary. According to RNC member Juliana Bergeron, that was due to teamwork.
We did make a lot of calls and worked with the other carve-out states, particularly South Carolina and Iowa, and I think the prior work paid off.
It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Give us a call. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. I'm Josh Rogers. Our guests this morning are Kevin Landrigan of the New Hampshire Union Leader, Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University, and Casey McDermott from New Hampshire Public Radio. First off, we're all obviously watching and listening to the reporting on the attack in Nice, and we'll be following that all day. This hour, we're going to be focusing on New Hampshire. And I guess I'll start with the news last night out of Cleveland as far as the Rules Committee of the RNC goes. According to our national committee people, the New Hampshire primary will be safe for 4 years from changes in the Republican calendar. What do you make of this, Kevin?
Yeah, it's a really good development and not necessarily an expected development. This was Republican National Committee man Steve Dupree made it clear this was a very strong threat he perceives. Outgoing Republican National Chairman Rince Priebus has made it clear that he wants to see a rotating assortment of states in presidential primaries, which would threaten New Hampshire's first in the nation status. There was a lot of discussion by the Rules Committee yesterday. What was the key vote and action was the creation of a commission to study the primary calendar. At that point, folks from New Hampshire, Iowa, South Carolina, Nevada, those who have the first four spots, could all breathe easy because they knew then that was their argument against any attempt to change the calendar for 2020. So we're pretty safe.
And so, Dean, is this an example of, the New Hampshire and the early state system, maybe the worst system, but for all the others that anyone can devise?
Well, there's always a debate every 4 years about what would be the optimal system. I know plenty of political scientists in my profession who have spent years thinking about what the optimal alternative would be. You know, the rotating states is one that we've heard for in regions or we've heard for many years. That's very complicated in terms of moving the dates around every 4 years. Others have suggested pairing up the early carve-out states with a nearby state to kind of broaden the reach of the primaries and make them more representative. We had this move towards a study commission in 2008 and 2012, so it's not unusual. The nice sort of hook in here is that any changes recommended need a 75% approval by the Rules Committee. So that's a high bar for any potential changes. So I think that's a good thing for Republicans and for New Hampshireites. It sounds like the early states, people like Jennifer Horn here and Steve Dupree and others did a lot of legwork to try to get the appropriate votes, and it was just sort of over before it really got going. I think also people were a little preoccupied with the whole delegate math issue and the Never Trump movement in the Rules Committee, which was also knocked down. We'll see. The report's going to come out in 2018. We'll see what happens. There were amendments in both the winter meeting and the spring, potentially in the spring meeting. So this is a really good outcome given what we had seen as a potential buildup in a push for change.
Well, one thing that's interesting is that, 2020 is 4 years away, and we obviously have November to deal with first. But, you know, Casey, you and I were looking at the schedule of visitors that the New Hampshire delegation is going to be seeing out in Cleveland, and you know, a lot of folks who are going to be looking at running in 2020, and so you're going to have people saying, of course, I think New Hampshire is fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, the schedule, if I'm not mistaken, includes people who have run for president before. So we had Scott Walker, we have John Kasich, who, if I understand correctly, is not actually attending the convention, but will be addressing the New Hampshire delegation at breakfast, which is kind of interesting that he's still going to make his case, and perhaps not surprising given how well he did in New Hampshire last year. But there's also people like Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, Joni Ernst, who's also viewed as kind of a rising star within the party. So I think, you know, like you said, this is kind of, as we wrap up or move toward wrapping up this year's election cycle, we're already seeing kind of the machinations in the works for
and
the people
nice.
Who
it shows
are going to
be. A little
be,
bit of buy-in by these candidates to the concept of New Hampshire as the first primary.
Exactly.
Well, certainly New Hampshire is along with the beneficiary of the ambitions of outside
state politicians.
Sounds
like it hasn't slowed down at all.
All right. And so why don't we turn to what happened in Portsmouth earlier this week. Bernie Sanders, you know, said Hillary Clinton will be the Democratic nominee, and he told the crowd he's going to do all he can to make sure she's president. This news was a long time coming, perhaps. Why do you think it happened now, Kevin, and why do you think it happened in Portsmouth?
Well, I think a couple of things. It's certainly Hillary Clinton's been on the losing end of this, and she's seen the benefits of this kind of kumbaya moment, if you will, in 2008. She had hers as the loser, like Bernie is the loser, in Unity, New Hampshire, with President Obama, the first rally that occurred between the two candidates. There was a campaign bus ride, too, that lasted about an hour and a half. I think you were on it, Josh. After the fact, a lot of books about the presidential campaign essentially said some real discussions started on that bus ride between Obama and Clinton about Clinton joining the administration if Obama were to win the presidency. And, of course, she became Secretary of State. Why does it happen in Portsmouth? Portsmouth's a great place because it's full of doctrinaire liberals. And those are the folks, those are the voters Hillary Clinton is most worried about now. People who were committed to Bernie Sanders, are they going to be enthusiastic? Are they not only going to vote, are they going to work for her? Are they going to raise money for her? Are they going to put a sign on the lawn? These are all things across the country that Clinton needs to worry about, because if she doesn't have that dedicated turnout of the party base, Donald Trump becomes president.
Well, one thing that was interesting, at least in my year in Portsmouth, was you know, not simply that Sanders spoke at great length, as those who covered him during the primary were used to, but he really focused a lot on issues that he said were part of his political revolution. And then when Hillary Clinton got up there, she also, you know, sounded, you know, some Sanders-like notes. Why don't we listen to what she had to say?
Inequality is too high, wages are too low, and it is just too hard to get ahead for too many Americans. We need an economy that works for everyone, not just those at the top, not just the millionaires and billionaires, but everybody. And to do that, we need to go big and we need to go bold.
Okay, that was Hillary Clinton in Portsmouth when she was accepting the endorsement of Bernie Sanders. And she talked about making the largest investment in the creation of jobs since World War II. And she talked about a number of policies, such as increasing the minimum wage, a public option for health insurance. Sanders talked about that as well. Tuition-free public college for those earning less than $125,000. This is all reflected, by the way, in the draft platform that came out of meetings in Florida. You know, do you think that sort of talk and this sort of platform is likely to be, you know, we're just going to be hearing that straight through to November?
Well, we'll see. You know, one thing I'm going to be looking for is the extent to which Sanders sort of follows up on the endorsement by campaigning in areas where he can draw strength. He has said quite emphatically that he would. You know, we'll see how it plays out. It was interesting. I mean, this was essentially his stump speech. Each section prefaced by the phrase, Hillary Clinton now agrees with me, X. Hillary Clinton now agrees with me, Y. He went right down the list of his key pieces. And, you know, we've been talking for the last year about how she has moved consistently to the left compared to where she was previously as a policymaker, and that's just sort of a necessity. You know, she's either doing it for tactical reasons or simply because she's now convinced that that's the way to go. And it sounds like she's proposed now this free public university tuition for below $125,000 family income. Sanders loved that. I think that helped. I think she's also bought into the $15 minimum wage now. I think she was down at 12. So clearly, for either, you know, is there ideological or tactical or whatever reasons, she has moved to the left. And my guess is he and his supporters will hold her to that. And if she starts to backslide, if you spend a few minutes on Twitter, you'll see it'll get pretty ugly pretty quickly.
I mean, one thing that was interesting is also that there were a fair number of so-called Bernie or bust people at this event.
Right.
And some walked out when he formalized his endorsement. Some were insistent to me beforehand that no, the media has it wrong. Bernie is not going to be endorsing Hillary today. You know, I spoke to some of these people. Why don't we hear what one person we spoke to in Portsmouth had to say about Hillary Clinton?
Her track record, decades of deception, corruption, the deaths that have come at her hand, and the wars and interventions, and her pro-fracking. I mean, it just goes on and on. Let's not get rid of money in government. Let's let the revolving door of government officials go into lobbying groups. It just is endless.
But do you have any concern about electing Donald Trump?
No, it's not my fault.
Okay, that was Bernie Sanders' supporter, Maggie King. And, you know, the specter of Donald Trump is something that Democrats are confident will ultimately allow them to capture much of the Sanders support. I talked to New Hampshire Democratic Party Chairman Ray Buckley, and he claimed that he had polling that was showing that the party is coalescing faster around Hillary Clinton than it did in 2008 when she and Barack Obama had a tough primary. But, you know, it's an open question whether or not all of the Sanders supporters are going to be there. And, you know, one interesting wrinkle when Sanders said, "I'm going to do everything I can to help you," it's unclear to me whether the thing that might be most helpful to Clinton will be essentially the voter file that the Sanders campaign has, and essentially turn that over, allow the Clinton team to go after these supporters. And, you know, we're going to hear a lot about Donald Trump. Do you think that's likely?
Yeah, I think so. I caught up with some of the members of the Democratic Party in New Hampshire about a month ago, both party officials and then other people who were Sanders supporters. And the party officials and the members of the Clinton campaign seemed to think at the time that Donald Trump was kind of the great unifier that would allow them to kind of, you know, bring in some of the Sanders supporters by, you know, painting the, in their view, you know, dire consequences of electing Trump as president by not uniting around her. But I do think it's interesting. We have actually Green Party candidate Jill Stein, who's going to be in New Hampshire this weekend. And according to a press release that we received yesterday, she's actually going to be having an event at the home of two Sanders supporters who hosted his first house party in New Hampshire. So there are a considerable number of people here who are, you know, turning to third party candidates or other options and not
Gary
moving
Johnson,
behind.
A couple of supporters, a couple of Sanders backers in Portsmouth said they were giving Gary Johnson a Libertarian.
Johnson is polling in national polls 11-12%. If he gets to 15%, he'll get into the debates. I think Cornel West, who is a big Bernie Sanders supporter, is endorsing Jill Stein. So, you know, even if Stein, you know, picks off 3% and some of that 11 or 12% from Johnson or Sanders supporters in a close race, that could be problematic. So I think these additional candidates introduce some variability and uncertainty into the overall race.
Okay, give us a call, 1-800-592-6477, and we have a call in from Richard from Manchester. Richard, what's on your mind?
Hello. Yes, I have a question. Democrats have made it very clear that they want to tie Kelly Ayotte to the Republican nominee. They demand Kelly Ayotte answer for every little thing she said or done by other Republicans. Meanwhile, Governor Hassan has not been called to account for the biggest issue plaguing Hillary Clinton, the FBI's findings about her private email. Hillary Clinton lied about classified information on her private server, lied only about using two devices, and lied about a series of other things relating to her private server, which has exposed some of our nation's top secret information. Will Hassan need to answer for her Hillary Clinton? Should she need to answer for whether she supports or condones Hillary's actions and lies?
Okay, Richard, got it. Thank you. So, you know, it's true that Ayotte and other Republicans throughout this primary season have been asked to, do you support Donald Trump in light of X, Y, and Z? I think part of that may be due to Ayotte's kind of arm's length stance on Trump. You know, Maggie Hassan has been a Foursquare supporter of Hillary Clinton. You know, she was in 2008, and she is now. What do you think about this, Kevin?
Yeah, Richard, it raises a good point, certainly. And it's something, by the way, that when it comes to attack machine politics, the Democrats are just flat out much better than Republicans are. So, Richard, and that's why Democrats are able to tie Ayotte to Trump much better than the Republicans are able to tie Hassan to Clinton, the negatives about Clinton. Governor Hassan has been asked about the email crisis before and that scandal, and her responses until recently essentially were, well, the FBI is conducting an investigation. It wouldn't be appropriate for me to comment. That investigation is concluded. There isn't it castigated Clinton for being extremely reckless with the use of emails, but didn't say there was cause to prosecute her for federal crimes, which has touched off a lot of anger in Republican circles. And I certainly submit, Richard, that as time goes on, Governor Hassan during this campaign will be asked more about it and will have to give a more complete response.
I mean, to your point, Kevin, about this being something that Democrats do, you know, more naturally and perhaps more aggressively. When Governor Hassan was addressing the crowd in Portsmouth, she talked about the Trump Ayotte ticket several times, and those sorts of, you know, phrases top many a Democratic press release and sort of roll off the tongue of Democratic politicians in the way we've yet to hear, you know, the Clinton Hassan ticket from Republicans. Certainly not out of the mouths of Kelly Ayotte herself.
Yeah, I do think Kevin is right. I think that part of the issue is Democrats really sense a vulnerability here, given how hard Ayotte has tried to avoid being tied to Trump. On the other hand, Hassan has very aggressively defended Hillary Clinton. I interviewed her a few months ago, and we asked her about all these questions, and she immediately started talking about Trump Ayotte and Trump foreign policy and Trump tax breaks for the wealthy with Ayotte. And so it just seems to be sort of a different focus. But I also agree with Kevin that Hassan will get her fair share of these questions as well. But she's just a lot more comfortable than Ayotte seems to be on this issue.
Yeah, one of the things folks need to remember about Kelly Ayotte and Donald Trump, it's not about in my view, and it's just my view, it's not about ideology. It's not about party loyalty. It's about gender. Kelly Ayotte understands that Donald Trump is extremely underwater among women voters. And Kelly Ayotte is running for re-election against one of the most popular women politicians, rising women politicians in this country, Maggie Hassan. And so Ayotte understands the more she's tied to Trump, the more women voters, particularly independent women voters, look at her in a very suspicious way. And that's why she's keeping her distance and will continue to all the way to Election Day.
I mean, she is keeping her distance, but there were comments she made to John DeStace of WMUR this week where it was essentially she reiterated there is no circumstance in which she can foresee not voting for Trump. You know, is that just simply a reality of the two-party system that you get this far in, and if you're reliant on Republican votes or Democratic votes, you have to kind of dance with who is ever bringing you?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's – and who are the only people who – that's a good segue, actually. Who are the only people who get to not be conscientious objectors in this election? Folks like Judd Gregg, who are out of politics now, who aren't up on the ballot this year, who gets to say these are really bad choices between someone, as he put it, who's extremely reckless, Hillary Clinton, and Donald Trump, who he described as pathologically self-absorbed, erratic, and with little or no depth of knowledge. He's not – you can tell this is a guy who doesn't need the approval of voters today.
All right. Coming up more on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup in just a minute on NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. You can join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email theexchange@nhpr.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter. We're joined by Kevin Landrigan of the New Hampshire Union Leader, Casey McDermott right here from NHPR and Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University. We have got an email from a Bernie or bust person. Steve on Plum Island says, nope, not going to vote for Clinton. And by the way, Sanders' endorsement of Clinton leaves me thinking that Sanders has abandoned the revolution. So good luck harvesting that vote, Team Clinton. Let's move to politics at the Senate level. A speech earlier this week Kellyette delivered at St. Anselm College. It was billed as being major by the campaign on foreign policy. It contained a lot of criticism of President Obama and talk of being more assertive, use of special forces operations, taking a harder line against Russia and Syria, more direct help to Kurds. Did you hear anything new in that speech, Dean?
This has been an ongoing discussion with Kelly Ayotte trying to kind of build on her experience with foreign policy. She's on Armed Services Committee and Homeland Security, so she has some experience with these issues. And we've seen her for a number of years now with Lindsey Graham and John McCain, getting some sort of foreign policy mentoring there. And it is an area where Maggie Hassan has had less experience. She was a little weak on it initially. She seems to have started to do her homework on it, but it's one of the big differences between being a statewide official in New Hampshire versus being a U.S. senator. Governors always talk about their trade missions as their as their foreign policy experience. So, it was a pretty sort of standard, anti-ISIS. Obama destabilized this Middle East with their troop withdrawal and, step up airstrikes and special operations. Did not talk, I don't think, about significant additional numbers of troops on the ground. But, given what just happened in Nice last night, this is sort of a part of a timely discussion. On the other hand, it may kind of get lost in the mix with all the other voices.
Well, Kevin, as Dean says, the thinking is foreign policy should be an area where would sort of augur to the benefit of Senator Ayotte. But, to the extent it has been a focus, and it's been a sort of limited focus thus far in this race, it's come up in the form of how to handle Syrian refugees, what to do about the closure of Gitmo. And on those issues, there really hasn't been any space between Kelly Ayotte and Governor Hassan.
No, there really hasn't. I think, in campaigns such as this, candidates always go to their comfort food, and during the race. And that is issues that they're comfortable with, that they feel they're well-versed with. But more importantly, that their consultants tell them, polling shows there's a built-in advantage over your opponent. And right now, in national security, there's a built-in advantage for conservative Republicans against Democratic candidates. That's why you're seeing across the country counterparts to Kelly Ayotte, Republican senators or Republican Senate candidates, are talking tough about ISIS. And the more, frankly, the more things that occur, such as a horror in Nice last night and in Orlando some weeks back, the Republicans feel the better it is for them. Conversely, that's why Governor Maggie Hassan always talks about abortion rights and Planned Parenthood, because she's got a built-in advantage among the voters against Ayotte, who opposes abortion rights, with voters on that issue.
Well, one thing I attended the speech, and one thing that was interesting to hear was, Ayotte went on at length about failures of the Obama administration. She didn't once invoke Governor Hassan. She didn't once invoke Hillary Clinton. She didn't once invoke Donald Trump. To the extent that foreign policy is really set by a commander-in-chief, does Ayotte's sort of on-paper strength on this topic become complicated by her kind of arm's-length attitude, towards Donald Trump? What do you think, Dean?
Yeah, sure. It's the reality of the situation she's in. As I said, when I talked to Governor Hassan a little while back, she immediately started talking about the Trump-Ayotte foreign policy. So it's something Kelly Ayotte's going to have to deal with. There's clearly some overlap in terms of their positions. But it does put her in a little bit of a difficult position. The senators, you're one of 100 people weighing in on this. But the Senate traditionally is viewed as having a little bit more of a kind of a role in sort of setting the, setting the feeling on foreign policy. But certainly there are many examples of presidents acting in fairly unilateral fashion in recent presidencies. So, there is some limits to how critical any one individual senator is to what a commander-in-chief does.
And one issue in which Senator Ayotte and Senator Shaheen were both in the news on this week a bit was the sending of this CARA, the Comprehensive Addiction Recovery Act, to President Obama. Both House and Senate have passed it at this point. you know, it's been hailed as the first major change to the country's policy in this area in a generation. What will this bill do, Casey?
So it's a mashup of a lot of different proposals, and there is some kind of contention around this because initially there had been, I think, a $1.1 billion request from President Obama to fund some of the programs that were included in here, but that money didn't make it all into the bill. And I know that's something that both Senator Shaheen and Senator Ayotte have taken issue with in terms of actually implementing change on a broader level. But generally speaking, I think the consensus is that this bill just kind of shifts the kind of strategy in the country from treating addiction as a crime or something to be kind of, responded to with aggressive force, to treating it with more compassion and more like a actual medical condition. So one of the interesting things that this does do is it expands the capacity for who's able to provide medication-assisted treatment. So that would be like Suboxone, things like that. And this expands it. My understanding is that it allows nurses and physicians' assistants to provide those services, which right now, if you're a treatment provider, that could leave you kind of scrambling to find a doctor or other people who are qualified. So from what I've been reading at the national level, some behavioral health people are saying that that's really a big step forward. And then there are a number of other provisions to provide grants to states and community centers to develop recovery and treatment initiatives, and also to encourage criminal justice entities to develop other programs that would steer people away from incarceration and punishment and toward more treatment options.
I mean, one bit of friction on this is the funding, and there was effort, failed narrowly, to add $600 million to it to fund some of these initiatives. Republicans say the money's going to come. But if we end up operating under a continuing resolution, is it fair to say that that is not necessarily likely to happen, Dean?
Yeah, we don't know yet exactly when the money will come, how quickly it will come. You know, we've talked before about Gene Shaheen's attempt to have a sort of a supplemental amendment that did get, I think, $600 million here more quickly. So, you know, there's always a concern that this stuff is not really done until it's done. And it could be, you know, some people are saying a year or two before we see any of the money. Hopefully it'll be quicker. But if nothing else, it seems like there are a lot of different moving parts finally at least heading in the same direction.
You know, Kevin, Casey described this as sort of a mashup of policies. I think that's a good way to put it.
And, it is.
You know, at the same time,
there were like 18 different bills in the House that this actually the Senate went with the single bill approach, but the House just split it up, as Casey pointed out, in all these policy provisions. And that's what took a little while, was this conference committee trying to mash them all together.
Well, we also have we've had progress at the legislature, the State House on this. We have this compact signed by the National Governors Association that Charlie Baker, Massachusetts, and Governor Hassan were you know, in leadership roles in this this compact. A lot of these deal with prescribing changes, guidelines, enhanced use of prescription drug database. There's a lot of overlap in all this. I mean, is this just sort of all of a piece?
Yeah, I think it is all of a piece, and I think it's all about government at all levels struggling mightily to come up with the silver bullet for this crisis. Meanwhile, word is we're going to break another record in 2016 in overdose deaths. The medical examiner's office has indicated we could have close to 500, and we thought 437 in 2015, which was an all-time record, was a crazy number. I think, it's bureaucratic, but I think one of the big moves happened at the executive council table this week, two no-bid contracts totaling $3 million. What's significant about that? More money, throwing more money at this problem. Well, it's all about expanding treatment. And the studies clearly show New Hampshire is so far behind the curve when it comes to capacity for treatment of folks who are addicted. And more importantly, folks who are early addicted, to try and intervene and keep them from becoming statistics that the medical examiner talks about.
You know, I think we've talked on the show before about polling out of UNH that shows that the opioid crisis is a top concern, if not the top concern, among New Hampshire voters. Casey, you were at a Republican gubernatorial debate last night. Was that reflected at all in what was discussed?
It was actually interesting. In fairness to them, they did say that they ran out of time for all of the questions that they had to ask. So to my recollection, there were no specific questions on this. But a number of the candidates throughout the night did nod to the crisis in their own, you know, remarks. I think all of them did at some point or another, and they all have kind of differing strategies in terms of what they think should be done on this. We saw some kind of, you know, a notable flare up between Councillor Chris Sununu and Manchester Mayor Ted Gatsis after Sununu made some comments earlier on this year about a lack of leadership at the local level. And you saw some people like Gatsis, who have been working at the local level, saying that that was kind of dismissive of the work that's being done by first responders. But I think, you know, they've all either laid out kind of formal plans to deal with it or have said that they would make it a priority in one way or another.
I mean, how do you think this – I mean, obviously you've covered lots of gubernatorial races and, you know, as somebody who's watched a few myself, this is really an issue that does not break on clear party lines. I mean, you have some people striking a more law and order approach than others. Do you think that this is an issue that's going to drive voters in any meaningful way, or just everyone has to look like they're, you know, rightfully concerned about something that's killing so many people in New Hampshire?
Yeah, I think much like, you know, this is the domestic equivalent of the war against terror. And by that, I mean everybody's for it, meaning fighting the opioid epidemic. Everybody's trying to do something about it. Everybody wants to gain political mileage in a campaign by talking about it. But it's not going to move any voters at all. It's not going to make it any easier for Republicans in this race for governor to choose between these candidates. Fortunately for voters, there's actually a fair amount of choice. And I thought Casey Peace pointed about the debate last night, pointed that out. This is going to be a very very aggressive primary race. We've got differences on Planned Parenthood. We've got an abortion. We have differences on Medicaid expansion.
Yes.
We've sat through a lot of primaries, you and I, Josh, in which you can't put a butter knife between all the candidates on the major issues. They're all social and fiscal conservatives in the Republican primary. That's not the case this time. It's going to be fun.
Well, it is interesting. I was looking back, and I was just trying to find, you know, how long it's been since you actually had four, you know, somewhat viable, like, you know, certainly can't count any of these people out candidates. And I think you probably have to go back to 2000 to see anything like this. And you know, Dean, what do you think that the candidates thus far, that we're seeing a debate about the future of the Republican Party in any meaningful way, or is it just simply the people who decided to put their name on the line?
I mean, I would think overall it's sort of a fairly experienced group of Republicans. I don't see any sort of huge ideological fault lines. I know Frank Edelblut is running as kind of an outsider and more of a libertarian candidate, but you know, Chris Sununu and particularly, you know, Jeanne Forster and Ted Gatsis have all been around New Hampshire politics for a long time. They're all well known. So it doesn't feel to me like the party is fundamentally being redefined in the state in the way it's being debated at the national level with the national party and Donald Trump. You know, on the opioid issue, it's one of those issues, as Kevin mentioned, it's so high visibility. Everybody's in favor of doing something. My guess is the level at which there are differences between the candidates is so granular that the average voter probably not going to really key in on it, and will end up voting on some of these other areas where there's a much kind of bigger difference in terms of philosophy.
But I mean, does the simple size of this field give anyone, I guess, what you call a structural advantage, like, you know, name ID in the case of Chris Sununu, or the fact that you've got four people that, you know, somebody who could lock up, you know, conservative voters who are going to turn out, like Frank Edelblum, might have, you know, an advantage that he wouldn't have in a
smaller race, a two-person race? I think Edelblum's chances certainly are much better than they otherwise would be. But I'm with you, Josh, meaning this primary, this very aggressive primary, is great for the Republican Party. Why is that? Republicans have lost 9 of the 10 last races for governor. And it's no coincidence, really, the last aggressive primary didn't have four, but it had three.
2002.
Yeah, 2002 with Craig Benson, Gordon Humphrey, and Bruce Keel. I mean, that was an aggressive, record spending, record turnout primary that Craig Benson won, and not by a lot, over Bruce Keel and Gordon Humphrey. He went on to become governor. I think Republicans see the same paradigm here. there isn't any question that I would say that Sununu's name recognition helps him a great deal. And it helps him to the degree that we have this blockbuster U.S. Senate race above it, which is going to take suck a lot of oxygen and a lot of media coverage in the fall. So I'd rather be with his faults, and we saw some of them last night in the debate, I'd rather be Chris Sununu with the name than Frank Edelblu without the name.
And you can see just in terms of how the other candidates have consistently been attacking Sununu, that's kind of a basic measure of front-runner status. If nothing else, if everyone's attacking the one person, you can sort of assume that he's seen as kind of the biggest target or the front-runner. I think Kevin's right. If this were a midterm election year, this would probably be the marquee race without the Senate race and the Trump-Clinton race on top of it. So I think there's a little bit of concern in terms of this race kind of elbowing its way into people's consciousness, given how crowded the political activity is.
So, Casey, you were in the room. Was there anything in the debate which, seemed to be decisive or?
Yeah. I think obviously they kind of hit all the marks, hit consensus on, they want to be business friendly. They want to promote kind of school choice, project a very anti-Common Core brand. But there were some interesting divisions. As Kevin and Dean pointed out, Sununu was kind of target number one for all of his competitors, which was, very evident last night. You had Edelblu coming after him, asking him to look closely at the Republican Party's stance on protecting life at all stages, which is basically their stance on abortion. This coming after Sununu has, been known as being a more pro-choice candidate. You had Gatsis coming after him on votes on the Executive Council related to contracts for Common Core. You had Forrester taking a swipe at his economic plan. She said that when she read it, she thought it might have been written by Maggie Hassan, which, as you can imagine, provoked a fair amount of jeers from the audience. But I think it was kind of interesting. I don't know, how many people picked up on it last night, but Sununu, at the end of the debate, when they were making their closing statements, said something to the effect of, listen, I'm the only one who can win in November. That's why I'm taking all of these shots from the Democrats right now, too. So I think that's his effort to make a plea to the broader base of voters, whereas you might have people like Forrester or Edelblu who are playing to kind of, the social conservatives within there, the party base. That's Sununu saying, listen, I want to play to a broad section of the New Hampshire Republic at large, not just Republicans, and making the case for why he could be the strongest candidate to do that.
I mean, I thought his comments on Medicaid are instructive in that respect. And, I guess we'll see what happens with voters. But, I mean, Democrats are certainly going to be eager to paint Republicans as wanting to throw people off of health insurance is the way they're going to put it. And, Chris Sununu did not indicate that he wanted to just leap straight into some sort of repeal of the expanded Medicaid.
Yeah, that's certainly a centrist, and he's done this on a couple issues, as Casey's pointed out. That's certainly a centrist position. That's a general election position. It's a very good one for a Republican candidate. You got to get through this primary. And as Sununu saw this week, the warring armies are getting reinforcements and powerful reinforcements. We see Jim Merrill joining the Ted Gatsis campaign. And we've had Mike Dennehy advising Jeanne Forrester, two of the finest political operatives on the Republican side in this state in a long time, who've advised presidential nominees, and they're with the enemies. That's not good.
All right. Coming up, more top New Hampshire Granite State headlines for our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Joined by Casey McDermott of NHPR, Kevin Landrigan, New Hampshire Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Let's turn away from politics for a minute. I want to turn to a story you covered this week, Kevin, about spiking rental rates in the state. New numbers suggest $1,200 median statewide monthly rental for a two-bedroom. Obviously, those rates vary widely, but it seems like this is a problem.
Yeah, no, this is a serious problem. The New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority did its annual rental cost survey And it's really certainly troubling for folks trying to find affordable housing. The vacancy rate statewide is 1.5%. If that sounds tiny, it's extremely tiny. I mean, on a national level, 1.5% would be the lowest vacancy rate since the 1960s when Kennedy was president. Last year, the national vacancy rate was 7.1%, okay? And rents have gone up 15% over the last 5 years. And there's a correlation between the two. It's a landlord-renter's market, meaning there are fewer apartments. There are fewer apartments than there are people chasing dwelling units. So as a result, costs can and do go up, and rents can be raised because the market will bear that. And Dean Christian, the executive director of the authority, gave a very strong statement essentially saying, I think this reveals a crying need for more affordable housing. And Josh will remember about 20 years ago, we were at that status in New Hampshire. There was a real problem with affordable housing in this state. How big is New Hampshire's problem compared to other states? Well, rents in Manchester, New Hampshire rose 7.5% just last year. That was the fourth largest in the country. I mean, Long Beach, California, you know, Colorado Springs, Vancouver, Washington were the only three places in the country that had rents grow faster in the past year than Manchester. It's a growing problem. It's a serious problem. And New Hampshire, as a state, would be like the 22nd highest rents in the nation if it was a city. The average rent in New Hampshire is higher than half of the 50 largest cities in the country.
So, Casey, Kevin brought up Manchester. You're our Manchester resident here. I mean, are the spiking rents, is that palpable?
Yeah. I mean, I can say, you know, I'm a 20-something. My friends and I have this conversation a lot. I moved to Manchester about 8 months ago, and I can say that when I was looking for a place to live, it was difficult to find something that was, you know, affordable to a young professional there. I have other friends who, you know, work in journalism, which is not necessarily the most lucrative, you know, career, but also others who work in, you know, law, finance. Mm-hmm. And I think across the board for young professionals, it is difficult to find a place that is within your price range. And I think that has larger implications for the state at this point, just in terms of, you know, you hear politicians at the state and local level talking about wanting to attract a younger workforce, keep people here. But, you know, if there's nowhere for them to live, that becomes really problematic. And there's a pretty small pool of available space in Manchester, let alone space that is within people's budgets. And I think that it's also important to note that, you know, having a place that's affordable and convenient to a young professional is one thing. But then when you're talking about people who are working in, you know, maybe hourly wage jobs, people who are working at the minimum wage, it you know, there's a very small section of housing that is affordable to people on the lower income end of things. So that also, you know, can be problematic, because if their income is being eaten up by their rent every month, that leaves less for them to spend on other things and keep the economy moving. So
Dean, as we you know, hear this, you know, at the same time we talk to economists and people who watch the employment, we have a low unemployment rate. You hear a lot of talk from economists that some employers are having a hard time filling certain jobs. Meanwhile, housing is tight. You know, what does this mean about the state of New Hampshire's economy?
Yeah, well, it certainly complicates the ability to bring people here and for jobs if they have the requisite skills, to get people to stay here who may go elsewhere in search of a lower cost of living. It's a complicated issue. I mean, clearly at one level, it's simply supply and demand. There isn't enough rental housing stock available to meet the need. You know, here in Concord and other cities, there are also these other debates about how do you balance affordable housing with upscale housing that will bring people in who have disposable income to spend in the core of the cities. We've had that debate here in Concord. There are implications for the kinds of tax breaks that cities and localities have to give in order to build the different kinds of units. It's certainly a problem. You know, it is a concern. It's fascinating to hear what Kevin was saying about that it's half the cities are lower rent. You know, it is all relative. I have friends and family who live in major cities where you're, instead of $1,200, you're paying $4,000 a month for a two-bedroom apartment. So it certainly is higher than I think people would like, and it's a concern.
But, Kevin, you've obviously seen, you know, so-called workforce housing bills,
yes.
try to make their transit through the state house. Is this something that you know, policymakers, the legislature, you know, history would suggest this is not likely this crunch is not likely to result in any sort of bills.
Or a government answer that's really going to move the needle, you know, significantly. I think the next governor will talk about this issue and trying to do something about this issue. But as we saw in that affordable housing crisis 20 years ago, the economy and a recession sort of took care of the lack of affordable housing in New Hampshire. And that's sort of one of the interesting things about this issue. Some economists truly believe that in a macro way, we're seeing a change, meaning we're seeing younger people who aren't interested in the white picket fence like they used to be anymore. And out of this recession, we're seeing a lot of people who like the mobility of renting versus the ball and chain that is a 30-year mortgage. And when we saw with the recession, with so many people thrown into foreclosure, getting underwater on their mortgages, a number of people transitioning out, becoming renters, and being happy renters. Hey, I don't need a snowblower anymore. I don't have to buy a lawnmower. Somebody's mowing my grass and plowing my snow. I can vote with my feet. When my lease is up in a year, if I don't like this apartment, I can't do that with a house. I think that whole philosophy is, and the degree it takes hold, is really even adding to the greater and greater crunch we're seeing in the rental market.
Okay, let us hear from you. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. We have a call in from Michael, who's calling from Concord. Good morning, Michael. Welcome to the Exchange.
Good morning. Somebody ought to ask why rents are going up so rapidly when the population is growing so slowly. And I think part of the answer would be local zoning regulations, perhaps property taxes, which add to the cost of housing, things like impact fees. Most of the zoning regulations were introduced in a climate where communities were trying to resist or manage or control growth. And now we want growth, and we have a system that perhaps works against it.
Okay, so that's Michael in Concord saying essentially we have a regulatory regime that was set up during kind of an incoming tide, and you know the tide has sort of gone out, and we have these regulations in place. Dean, you have any thoughts on that?
I think he laid it out quite nicely. It is true at the municipal level, you know, these kinds of projects become very complicated to shepherd all the way from conception to actually opening. And it is precisely for these, you know, reasons it gets very complicated in terms of the funding and the zoning and kind of what the mix is going to be. Also true for, you know, regular property owners who want to make improvements or changes to their dwellings. They also have to deal with the zoning as well. So I think that's certainly part of the mix. And I think that's why it's so hard to kind of quickly solve this problem, because it is a very kind of slow process to introduce new housing stock to the market.
All right. Let's turn to another story that's been, you know, top of the fold the last couple days, which is another rough news week for Phillips Exeter Academy. A report in the Boston Globe this week detailed the prep school's effort to, I guess you could call it, informally resolve a sexual assault allegation from an incident that occurred last October. What's the allegation, Casey?
So the allegation is that there was a student who had been assaulted by another student, and when these concerns were brought to people of power at the university, I believe there was a school minister who was involved in this. One of the resolutions that was arrived upon was that the alleged assailant would bake bread and deliver it to the girl he was accused of assaulting as an act of penance for the rest of the year. And those who are familiar with, I think, kind of the nature of sexual assault and those kinds of experiences could probably tell you that that would be pretty traumatic to someone who has been assaulted to have to kind of repeatedly see the person that assaulted them over and over again. So these issues, among others, were brought to light, as you said, in a pretty in-depth story in the Boston Globe. And this comes on the heels of, you know, of course, other broader issues with the school's handling of incidents between members of its faculty and students over a period of years. And I think was, you know, probably just kind of the latest to have people, both alumni and otherwise, call into question, you know, how much this school was doing to really take care of the students that are entrusted to it. It is a boarding school. It's a private school. So people really kind of, you know, put their kids in the hands of the people who are running this. So that, I think, was probably troubling to a number of people who read these.
Yeah, the girls' parents weren't informed about this incident. And, you know, apparently there was another allegation involving the same student. Ultimately, the young woman went to the police, and the former rector of students who are going to be arraigned next month on misdemeanor assault charges. Dean, obviously, you've spent a lot of time on campuses. You know, this is a high school campus, but I think one reason this story is shocking a lot of people is its timing. This came as Exeter and other boarding schools in New Hampshire and elsewhere were sort of grappling with these issues. And, you know, the idea that you would try to informally resolve something certainly flies in the face of what Exeter was saying publicly about other things.
Yeah, you know, it's pretty stunning. And, you know, the one small saving grace for a lot of these prep schools, perhaps with the exception of the Owen LaBrie episode at St. Paul's, a lot of these schools like, you know, Exeter and Groton and St. George's and others, a lot of the abuse they were talking about was really sort of 1970s, 1980s, and coming to grips with something that had been in the past and making changes. This is a contemporary example of a situation not being handled well, and that's really problematic for these schools and quite surprising. And, you know, I mean, universities are different where I spend my time because, you know, everybody's, you know, usually over 18 or older, so they're adults. The schools are a lot more focused on having safeguards in place, although, you know, relationships happen and abuse happens at university level as well. But this particular sort of issue with these elite prep schools and minors, particularly in the 70s and 80s, you thought that the conversation was moving in a good direction. And then you hear even the Exeter issues that we have heard about recently were all, I think, 70s and 80s with maybe one or two exceptions. So this is really troubling that it's still being handled in an ineffective way.
And apparently it's troubling at least a decent slug of Exeter alumni. Apparently 700 Exeter alumni have signed a petition saying they're going to withhold financial support. You know, we have an email on this from Steve saying, how will the Exeter Academy scandal spill over onto New Hampshire's governor? And, you know, it's an interesting question and one that, you know, certainly Governor Hassan's husband was the principal at Exeter, not during this incident, but was there and has taken some flack for his handling in the wake of the resignation of Rick Schubart, a longtime teacher there who would acknowledge having sexual relationship with students in the 70s, I think. And so in any case, you know, this is something that Republicans did sort of try to jump on, including Senator Ayotte herself sent out a statement on Senate letterhead talking about Exeter back then. You know, it sort of died down as an issue. Given the amount of money that's going to be spent in the Senate race, I would personally be shocked if we don't see ads from outside groups going at this. Do you think that's proper to expect, Kevin?
No, you nailed it, Josh. Absolutely. This is an issue you sort of make a lot of hay about when it first comes out and it becomes a controversy. And then you put it in the bank as a campaign. And certainly Ayotte has some pedigree to talk about this. I mean, she spent a couple of years going to college campuses talking about federal legislation to create more of a zero-tolerance policy, a more of aggressive status in terms of dealing with allegations of sexual assault on college campuses long before this controversy emerged. So she can say I was doing something about it and allege that the governor's husband was keeping it quiet on a prestigious campus in order to keep everybody happy. But Dean is better equipped to know than anyone. But to me, this week's development is most troubling for Philip Sexer, that developing the petition you speak of. When 700 alumni sign a petition and say we'll withhold money, and we view this as a vote of no confidence for the present leadership of that school, that can be a cancer. It really can. And this school and its administration has to get its arms around this and show that it's actually doing something demonstrably positive, or it's in deep trouble.
Yeah, and these kinds of episodes always result in pressure on the headmaster to resign in these different schools, and you know, they're sort of stuck trying to hold on to their position, but also address the concerns of the alumni and the community. And it's just, you always end up in a difficult position. And I think you're right. You know, Republicans will make at least a circumstantial case against Hassan, Governor Hassan, and her husband. And you know, I think they'll come back to it occasionally, as you've suggested.
All right, we're almost out of time, so I'm going to have to forgo my question on Pokemon Go. But I will ask, I'm headed to Cleveland next week for the Republican convention. What are you going to be up to, Kevin?
Working on the New Hampshire House election. Obviously, a lot of the tension on the U.S. Senate race and the governor's race. State Senate, we have 8 senators not running for your election. Like a well-oiled flipper on a pinball machine, the New Hampshire House goes back and forth 4 times since 2006. So we'll look at that.
All right, Casey, what about you?
I will be preparing to go to Philadelphia the week after next for the Democratic convention. So just trying to kind of catch up with the delegates and New Hampshire's Democrats about what they're expecting there.
Dean?
Be watching the conventions. It's convention season. What else? Yeah, it's the thing to do.
It is the thing to do. All right. Thank you for joining us on NHPR's weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Alan Grimm. Our producer is Jessica Hunt. Intern Sam Ruthier. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. The theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Josh Rogers. This is The Exchange on NHPR.